Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hi, I'm Ann Hillman. Last week, the president was in Alaska, and so was the White House science advisor, John Holdren. Holdren painted a sobering picture of climate change in the North during his speech at the State Department's Glacier Conference in Anchorage. But before Glacier got underway, Holdren had a briefing with a handful of Alaskan scientists. Two of them join us today in the program. My guests are Jeff Welker and Eric Klein, both from the University of Alaska Anchorage. Thank you both very much for being here.
Sure. Our pleasure.
Dr. Jeff Welker is the Fulbright Distinguished U.S. Arctic Chair in Norway. He's also a biology professor at UAA. And Dr. Eric Klein is a research scientist in the biology department at UAA. Thanks very much. Before we get started, can you each sort of sum up what sort of research you're doing here in Alaska?
I'll say a few things first. Some of the things that I've been working on center around how Arctic ecosystems will behave in the future. And one of the ways that we've been able to do that is set up experiments in different parts of the Arctic. So at Tulik Lake, for instance, on the north slope of Alaska, about 130 miles south of Prudhoe Bay, the University of Alaska, in cooperation with the National Science Foundation, has a research site there. It's been going since about 1970. Beginning in 1994, we started an NSF project there, asking questions how tundra will behave if you have a different winter, but also a different summer in terms of the amount of snow and the temperature. And so up there, we've had that project ongoing for almost 22 years now. So it's one of the longer term field experiments creating a climate scenario. We've had a second group of studies that have been underway in Northwest Greenland. Asking similar questions. How will these very high Arctic ecosystems respond in the future? And so we've taken many measurements, everything from soil processes to trace gas exchanges, as well as some aspects of the water cycle.
And so are you simulating different scenarios?
We're creating scenarios. That's exactly right. And so oftentimes when people are trying to forecast the future, they say it could be a little warmer, it could be a lot warmer. And how will the system behave? We're not only interested in that warming question in terms of summers being warmer or cooler, but also our summers wetter or drier, and then also the winter. The winter is really an important part of the Arctic, and so it's 250 of the 365 days, and so winters are starting to show some changes. Sometimes we see more snow, sometimes we see less snow. Sometimes you have more snow associated with a dry summer, sometimes you have more snow associated with a wet summer. So you can see that there's a combination of scenarios that we're interested in because we're just uncertain what the Arctic will be like in the future.
All right. And Eric, what are you looking into?
Some similar aspects to Jeff, but also some differences. I look at changes in water and water cycles throughout Arctic and subarctic areas, as well as modern climate and historical or paleoclimate processes. So for paleoclimate processes, we take sediment cores, or basically plugs of the earth from wetlands or lakes or even glaciers, and we can collect signals from these cores that can help us reconstruct everything from changes in temperature to precipitation patterns to how water cycled through past warming periods and cooling periods. And then we use modern measurements to help understand these changes that we're seeing from these earth cores that we collect to help reconstruct past. So we essentially use modern measurements to help explain what we're seeing in the past as well. So it's a connection, and we use a lot of isotopes it's basically just a word that we can use as tracers to help understand how everything from carbon and water are moving through different parts of the Earth's system.
So your combined work is looking at a lot at the changing Arctic and what that could potentially mean for the future. That was definitely one of the major topics discussed by the science advisor from the White House during the Glacier Conference. Before we jump further into the conversation and what you guys spoke with him about, let's look at a quick video segment of the highlights of his speech.
It is a real honor for me to be able to be with you this morning to talk about the science of climate change in the Arctic and its impacts in and beyond the Arctic. The Arctic report card by NOAA in this year reported that the warming Arctic atmosphere was strongly connected to lower latitudes in early 2014, causing cold air outbreaks in the eastern United States and warm air intrusions into Alaska and northern Europe. And you see that wavy pattern of the jet stream. So impacts of climate change within the Arctic region. We start, of course, with shrinking sea ice, one of the most publicized of these trends. The area of Arctic sea ice in late summer is over 40% smaller than it was in the late 1970s. The volume of the ice is down by even more because it's getting thinner as well as smaller in area. Open water instead of ice also means bigger waves and loss of shoreline protection, leading to coastal erosion and damage, even evacuation for coastal settlements, and those problems are made worse by sea level rise globally. And this is a photo made just a few days ago near Point Lay on the northwest Arctic coast of Alaska, showing thousands of walruses hauled out on land because the ice on which they ordinarily haul out and below which they feed has disappeared. Thawing permafrost. A high proportion of land in the Arctic and the subarctic is in the permafrost region. For the state of Alaska, 80% of the area of Alaska. And the impacts of thawing include land subsidence threatening buildings, roads, energy infrastructure. They include increasing vulnerability to coastal erosion and to wildfires. And they include exposure of previously frozen soil carbon to release as carbon dioxide and methane. The future of Arctic climate change and its impacts. In terms of temperature, the most recent assessment by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, looking at the Arctic particularly, projected that summer temperatures in the Arctic in the last 20 years of this century, under business as usual growth in emissions, would average about 4 degrees C, that is 7 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the level already achieved in the period 2005 to 2015. The actions that are needed fall in three categories: mitigation, preparedness, resilience, adaptation, and research. Thank you very much.
So looking, when we were watching that video, Eric, I noticed you were nodding here and there. Do you feel like his remarks were spot on? Did he hit on some of the important things that you really hoped he would?
I think so. I think he encapsulated a lot of what Alaskans, both people studying it as well as people just walking around and seeing these changes. A lot of these changes, you don't need to be a scientist to observe. They're out there, you can see them. And so when we had the opportunity to speak with him, he spoke about a lot of these similar aspects, touching on what are these signs that we're seeing in Alaska as well as other parts of the Arctic. And one of the main points he wanted to convey is that there is interest, there is awareness. We will be, we being the administration, the federal level, being more involved and aware and trying to understand better what's going on and being there to help coordinate between the state of Alaska, indigenous groups, scientists, bring all these groups together, bring all the stakeholders, all the players together to help understand what's going on and hopefully make a better sense of the larger picture.
Jeff, do you feel like he was hitting on the most important topics?
Yeah, I thought one of the things that he did really well was he helped people understand and connect the Arctic system to the lower latitudes. And this is something that's really important for us as kind of a nation, is that sometimes Alaska is seen a little bit like Hawaii as being this very distant place. This Arctic really doesn't kind of affect us. But one of the things that's been happening is this wavy pattern that we're seeing. What we really have been able to appreciate now is that the way that these different high pressure systems sit around the globe, how the jet stream is moving around the top of the planet, really is causing situations where warm air is coming up from Hawaii. That's why we have these mild winters. It rolls over the top of Alaska, and then it drops down very precipitously through Canada, and that allows cold air to drain out of the Arctic, and it brings those cold, snowy, beautifully skiable winters into the East Coast, which they've had. And so when it snows in Washington, it's actually a good thing because it raises people's awareness of this teleconnection. And so this is something that I think our country as a whole is becoming aware of, is that the lower latitudes are tied to the Arctic climatically. And this is giving people an appreciation for the fact of where it is and how important it is to their own livelihood.
So in some ways, he was really speaking to folks outside of Alaska and not really Alaskans.
I think he was speaking to the country and to this global community. I mean, the people in the audience were obviously other people from the Arctic nations, and really reiterating to them just the consistency of the changes that are occurring. I think he spoke to several things that are really important to us here in Alaska, things like permafrost. Mm-hmm. As Eric was mentioning, these peatlands are a real important part of the carbon balance of the North, but permafrost is also an important part. We see evidence now that the ancient carbon cycle, the carbon that is locked up in permafrost, is now interacting with the modern cycle, the modern carbon cycle.
Take a step back, what does that mean to have the ancient carbon cycles interacting with the modern ones?
So the ancient carbon cycle might be when plants were assimilating carbon thousands and thousands of years ago. Mm-hmm. So during times of mastodons and things like that in Alaska, okay. You had vegetation that was accumulating carbon out of the atmosphere just like it's doing now. But then those systems became frozen, that soil became frozen and became our permafrost. And then because it's frozen, it never is really releasing any of that ancient carbon into the atmosphere. And so the carbon cycle has a tendency to be kind of very short. So a little bit of carbon's taken in and a little bit comes out. But as those active layers get deeper and deeper, the permafrost is thawing. Carbon that never really touched our atmosphere today is now starting to leak into the atmosphere. And it's a feed-forward process where a little bit of warming adds to kind of thawing of the permafrost. Thawing of the permafrost adds CO2 to the atmosphere, a little bit more warming. And so this is a really important part of the global carbon cycle, is the fate of this very large and ancient pool of carbon that has in the past been disconnected from the carbon cycle of today.
Sure. Yeah, and along those lines, just an analogy that I've heard before and I think works great. If you think about, say, a piece of broccoli that's frozen and you buried that broccoli in the ground, there's organic carbon in that broccoli. Say you buried it 1,000 years ago, it's been frozen into the ground for 1,000 years. All that carbon in the broccoli stays there. However, if the environment changes, that the ground thaws out, that broccoli thaws out, it doesn't melt, it thaws out. The ground thaws out, which exposes that broccoli, which used to be frozen, to atmospheric environmental conditions. So those conditions allow that organic matter to decompose, to decay, and that carbon that was once stored in that frozen broccoli is then released back into the atmosphere, whereas it was frozen for over 1,000 years, just as an example. It can be frozen for thousands mm-hmm. of years. But when you take a change to the ground and change the thawing levels, you expose all that frozen broccoli, yeah. so to speak, across the landscape to atmospheric conditions.
And similar things, it sounds like, are happening within peatlands, which are much of Alaska's surface as well.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. yes. I've spent some time studying and researching peatlands. There's a large amount of organic carbon mm-hmm. Stored in peatlands.
And like the wetlands.
Yeah, and peatlands are a wetland. There's a specific type of wetland that accumulates partially decomposed organic matter. So essentially, plants photosynthesize and bring in carbon through the atmosphere. And then some of this organic matter doesn't decay, mm-hmm. and it builds up over time in peatlands. And you get these sediments that accumulate, and each one of those sediments has plant material with partially decomposed mm-hmm. organic matter carbon in it. And they're all over Alaska. I'm sure everybody's walked through a peatland. Some people hate them. They're very difficult to walk through at times.
They're squishy.
They swallow yeah. your boots. Mm-hmm. They're everywhere. So one of the big questions in terms of climate change and potential impacts is, what is the fate of this large amount of organic carbon? Because in the northern latitudes, the amount of carbon stored in peatlands is about 50% of what's currently in the atmosphere right now. So if all that carbon was released back into the atmosphere, it obviously would have a huge impact on the amount of carbon in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of the questions that we collectively as a scientific community are trying to understand, is what is the fate of the carbon stored in these peatlands under climate change? Is it going to release, or under some conditions, maybe if it's warmer and wetter, you might get conditions where it actually accumulates? So that's just one example of a lot of these different systems mm-hmm. that are being impacted by changes in climate, particularly in northern latitudes.
And was that some of the science you guys were focusing on when speaking with John Holdren? Was that one of the things that you felt like the White House needed to understand better?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, they're very much, very engaged in the scientific literature and the research activities of people both in the lower 48 that work in Alaska and those that are in the Alaska University system that are also working in Alaska. And so during his visit to UAA, and that Sunday afternoon we had a chance to share with him the variety of research topics that are being covered here on our campus that specifically speak to some of these issues. And some of the groups that we have on campus, we have kind of four main thematic areas at UAA that deal and kind of address climate change. We have kind of the life and earth sciences, a little bit that, that Eric and I work in, and several others within our community. We have a group in engineering, so we have an engineering group that works on coastal erosion and storm surge. Tom Ravens is heading up a lot of that. We also have a group, Rhonda Johnson, over in some of the health sciences. So we have a health science program at UAA that's very interested in human health in these changing environmental conditions, how people are coping with these changes that we're seeing. And then we have kind of a social, ecological, educational group as well. And so, for instance, ICER, which is Marie Lowe, Diane Hirschberger, and some of those folks are very interested in how these social systems are changing, as well as the economics of some of this. So really, we talked to John about what our specific programs were and how they are adding to this kind of global understanding.
Because it's about more than just the science of what's going on in the soil and what's going on in the air.
Oh, it's much more than that. And I think that one of the things that we've tried to do here, like this table at UAA, is to bring groups in from different perspectives, but to think about a common problem, an issue that we might have. And what you realize in today's system is that it's very much kind of an ecological social system. And we as a community now realize that the humans are a big part of this issue and have been contributing to it, but it also means that we can participate in solving it. And I think that's one of the things that the president, I felt, spoke to really quite clearly, and John, obviously, as being part of that staff, speaks to that as well, is that yes, this is a bit of a dilemma, we have a challenge, but we can also provide some of the solution to this.
So you felt like they were really listening?
I think so, and along those lines, one of the points that came up in our discussions was that there is more awareness, and with that greater awareness, we're starting to understand the interconnections between these earth systems, social systems, science systems. And that's one of the comments that they're making as well, is that, oh, almost every month, every 2 months, et cetera, these different time periods, we're realizing here's another issue that's connected to something that we didn't even know about before. And with time, we're starting to bridge these connections. And that's one of the points they're making, is that we really want to make an effort to bridge these connections between people, between the ground, between hunting, fishing. We're starting to understand these connections. So what does that knowledge do for us? How can we learn more from understanding these connections?
Right. So let's move on a little bit to some of the research you guys are working on very currently. You were both recently on the icebreaker Healy. Jeff, tell me a little bit about why.
Well, one of the things that's happened here at UAA is we've recently been awarded a Center of Excellence from the Department of Homeland Security. It's called the Arctic Domain Awareness Center. Dr. Wozinski has led this effort for us here. Our client with regards to this center is the Coast Guard. So when you think about borders in the U.S., you have the Border Patrol that thinks about our kind of land-based borders, so we have a group of people that are responsible for that. Homeland Security also is responsible for our coastal borders and thus our maritime systems, and so the Coast Guard leads that effort. And so as part of this new Arctic Domain Awareness, and our responsibility now to the Coast Guard to help them develop new technologies to increase their ability to really understand and recognize what's happening in the marine habitat, including issues of sea ice, number one. So the fact that we're going to be having increased ship traffic in a very difficult system here. So building new technologies, testing new technologies that might make a ship more aware of sea ice conditions. And then the other one that we were especially interested in is detecting petroleum out in the marine system. So again, an important aspect of drilling for oil or ship traffic is, you know, are there unusual petroleum events that are happening? And so we took some technology on the Healy that allowed us to measure aspects of the water cycle, which are associated with sea ice, and aspects of the carbon cycle, which are associated with petroleum.
Okay, and it sounds like you had some fairly unique technology, a sniffer?
We had, a term that's been developed. It does, in a sense, sniff the atmosphere. It's a system that collects continuous atmospheric samples and pulls them into an analyzer. And in this analyzer, we're able to look at the isotopic compositions of water and carbon.
Pause. Isotopic compositions.
Absolutely. Basically, we look at the isotopes, which are, for example, water. Water is composed of oxygen and hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And hydrogen and oxygen both have heavy or light forms or isotopes. So you can have a hydrogen 18 and you can have you have an oxygen 18 and an oxygen 16. The oxygen 18 is heavier than the oxygen 16. So because of that difference, they respond differently to environmental conditions. So the whole basis of a lot of understanding how these isotopes are useful to us is that their preferential evaporation, the lighter isotope is preferentially evaporated, and preferential precipitation, the heavier isotope is preferentially rained out. So if you have a condition, say when we're looking at sea ice, if you have sea ice cover along on the Arctic Ocean, the isotopic properties of the atmosphere are going to be much different than, say, if you take that sea ice and have open water. Because if you have open water, you're evaporating all that water, and that allows more of the lighter isotope. In this case, example, oxygen 16, you'll get more of that evaporating, and then more of the heavier isotope staying in the water. So that's just an example of how these isotopes can tell us what's going on.
It's almost like there's an invisible photo floating in the air, and it's composed of different things depending on how much water is exposed versus how much ice is exposed. And by getting a sample of the air, it's like you can see the photo.
Oh, absolutely. It's very
cool. Brilliant.
It's very cool, and it's amazing. We're just starting to learn more and more about what we can do with these technologies. Mm-hmm. And we're using real-time continuous samples, which is very new. The ability to do this is quite new. In the past, you'd take periodic samples, whether from precipitation or rain, any kind of water has a signal. What I'm drinking right now has a signal composed of oxygen and hydrogen isotopes that can tell us something about this water, where it came from, and its behavior. So yeah, it's great. And what we were doing is looking at the vapor, the atmosphere, because there's water vapor all the time. The concentrations vary depending on the humidity, but it's always there. So it's essentially seeing what's in the air in a new way, and pulling signals out of that to understand everything from carbon cycling to water, and it's pretty fantastic. There's a lot we can learn, and we're really excited.
You guys took GoPro videos of some of your work. We actually have a short bit. Let's take a look, and maybe you guys can explain what's going on in the video.
That would be great. This is a Coast Guard Cutter Healy. It's about 450 feet long. On the back is a helipad. This is a tethered balloon called an aerostat. It's about 100 feet in the air. It's being held on to the back of the boat. This device that the camera is on is actually designed to kind of increase the ability to kind of see the environment. So as you can see, you can see quite a distance in the horizon. When you're on a vessel like this and you're trying to kind of find your way through the ice, sometimes it's very difficult to see very far off the front of the boat. So the example there was actually this tethered balloon, which was expanding some of the capacity of the, for instance, the people that might be steering the boat. Mm-hmm. And this mission, this Healy mission that we were part of, really was designed as kind of an R&D mission. So it brought people in from, you know, the kinds
R&D,
of
research
and development.
Okay.
Yeah. So research and development, new technologies to help the Coast Guard and thus, you know, maritime individuals, you know, globally, use new technologies to kind of sense what's going on out in the environment. So, for instance, not only did we have our device that was sampling the air out the front of the boat the entire time, but we had other individuals that had UAVs on board, so a small drone that was actually being used and flown off the back of the boat to kind of expand visibility. And then we also had UAVs, underwater devices
that went under the ice.
Under the ice, it could collect video and still shots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we had communications, so that was another one. So this was kind of the aerostat off the back of the boat was kind of a communications test. And then we came all the way around the coast of Alaska, all the way to Prudhoe Bay, and then we did a search and rescue practice. And so this is one of the Coast Guard is going to get the call. The Coast Guard is going to get the 911 call that we, you know, Houston, we have a problem. And it's going to be Kodiak, we have a problem. And so the Coast Guard is trying to practice how you would do rescues and those kind of things. And so on this mission, we ended up spending a couple of days off about 30 miles off Prudhoe with putting dummies in the water, helicopters flying out, both private and Coast Guard. ConocoPhillips was involved in this as well. And so they practiced divers coming off the helicopters and actually practicing rescuing people out of the water.
You guys seem to have accomplished a lot in a very short time. Well, thank you both very much for being here. It's the end of our program. Thanks for joining us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.